This is Alex Gibney, director of Finding Fella, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Hello, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio, the independent film chat show. Thank you for listening. This is a really great episode, I have to say. It's all very timely, though, so I really made a point of getting up an extra show this week because one of the guests, Alex Gibney, who most people who watch documentaries probably know quite well, his new film, Finding Fella, about the globally famous musician Fela Kuti, is hitting theaters today. And the other filmmaker who is my guest is Dan Kraus, who made a film called The Kill Team, which actually came out last Friday in New York City and is opening up wider starting today. And I wanted to make sure to get up this interview as quickly as I could. So we're going to get into those two interviews in just a few moments. I want to just say that I met Alex Gibney at the offices of Kino Lorber. Kino Lorber is a distributor, if you don't know. They distribute all sorts of art films. You can go to their website and just check out all the marvelous films they distribute. And I have a new relationship with them. A somewhat more annotated version of this interview is going up on their site as part of a new interview series I do for them. But you can also hear it all here on Film Wax Radio. And so I'm very, very excited about it. And it's bringing up all sorts of new opportunities for great conversations, which I can then record and play for you. And that's the whole idea. So Alex Gibney, this is a guy who has a real operation going there. I first became aware of Alex Gibney after I saw Taxi to the Dark Side, and he got an Oscar for that. But before he did, I actually did get an opportunity to interview him. Alex was already on the map, of course, even before Taxi to the Dark Side, because he had made Enron the smartest guys in the room, which probably was the documentary that put him on the map. But Taxi to the Dark Side made him, of course, that much more famous because he got the Oscar for that. And since then, holy crap, this man, his outfit, because, of course, he can't do all that he does alone. But I would even just cherry pick a few titles, but they're also, impressive. There's the Hunter S. Thompson documentary he made called Gonzo, The Life and Work of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, Casino Jack and the United States of Money, which was, of course, his documentary on super lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Then there was My Trip to Al-Qaeda, Freakonomics, where he had one of the segments in that omnibus documentary, Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer, The Magic Trip, Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God, about Catholic priests and the church's reaction to predatory behavior, Park Avenue, Money, Power, and the American Dream, which is something I highly recommend, that if you haven't seen that one. We Steal Secrets, The Story of WikiLeaks, and The Armstrong Lie, all have come out in only about 5 or 6 years, if you can imagine that. And in the meantime, Finding Fella opens today in New York. Let's see. If you love music and you love Fela Kuti, then you can see it. It's at the IFC Center as of today, August 1st, and running through the next week at the very least. And then it's going to be in other spots around the country in the coming weeks. It's going to be even at the Harlem Mist. So actually starting next week, a week from today, Friday the 8th of August, you can see it at Mist up in Harlem. So there you go, right there. But in the meantime, this is my conversation with Alex Gibney, and he opens up quite a bit. So I think you'll be, I think you're going to dig this conversation.
I am Bella, who no mortal can ever kill. So let us turn Nigeria upside down. I am the law and will do what I please. So yeah, man.
No diplomacy, no compromises, no agreement.
He was an original artist, made a form where there was no form.
When you think of Parliament Funkadelic, Bob Marley's Wailers, Africa 70 was one of the great bands that ever played black music.
He has no fear to get thrown in jail every time a single comes out.
Basically, the idea of Nigeria is that militaries run this place. People were very scared. And then there's one guy, they say, speaking out against military.
Straight and progressive, clean government that knows what it's doing.
I knew that this was trouble. Everybody knew this was trouble.
There was so much corruption and so much ziggy-zaggery going on. The fellow was a thorn in their flesh. I mean, he was naming names.
Everybody say yeah, yeah.
How about you?
All right.
What? Got upstate?
For the weekend. Yeah. Up by Bard College.
Oh, sure. My daughter's going there.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I went there, too.
Did you?
And what year is she in?
She's going to be a freshman.
Oh, she's just starting?
Yeah.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah. It's, oh, my God. Well, since I've been there, the campus has exploded.
Yeah.
And my son's mother was in a play up there right now this summer.
Hmm.
And, I mean, it's they've got so much arts up there. I mean, it's incredible.
Right.
I guess the original theater that was up there when I was there burned down. Subsequently, they got, like, a Frank Gehry to design the current Performing Arts Center.
Yeah, so it's beautiful. Beautiful
I guess
center.
You were up there, of course.
Yeah, my eldest daughter also went there.
It's amazing.
I'm an honorary Bardian.
By osmosis or whatever.
Right.
We last chatted at the Magnolia holiday party last winter, so I look vaguely... I think I kind of accosted you. Yeah, Finding Fella is coming out...
1st of August.
Friday, August 1st. Okay.
Right.
Got my ducks in a row here. Great. One other thing, and, you know, because I read it on the internet, I can't be 100% certain that this is true about you, but is it true your stepfather was William S. Coffin?
That is correct.
That's an interesting little fact. I didn't know that until I started reading a little bit more, and I met him a few times.
At Riverside? Yeah.
Once there, but also when I was growing up, I went to a summer camp up in Vermont.
Mm.
And as you, of course, well, this is even ridiculous to say as you know, but as you know, of course, he was up there in the Thetford Fairley area.
Yes.
And that's where the summer camp was. And so the director of this camp had a relationship with him already. So there were a number of occasions where he came by or we met him in that town. For whatever purposes, and
Stratford, I think.
Stratford,
it?
Yeah, yeah. It's all the right. It's these little towns, are, of course, like these archetypal New England towns.
Right,
they're just gorgeous. But he was a lovely guy.
Yeah,
and
great
a really
good guy.
Well, awesome. Yeah, I bet you do. And
my mom was married to him for not quite 10 years, They had known each other when they were younger and then got reacquainted when I was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he was indicted for conspiracy with Dr. Spock.
Yes.
And so he was up in Boston for the trial. And so he would come by the house after court. He would court my mom after court. So
they got the better version of court. They got together.
And... And then we moved to New Haven when I was, I guess, around 15.
So pretty much these were very impressionable years for you.
I was a sponge.
I mean, these are civil rights. Was your mom very much involved in progressive politics?
She was of a progressive bent. She wasn't, you know, when they met, she was running the... she was head of health education at Children's Hospital in Boston. And she did things like they put out books about, you know, how to take care of your health. And she helped to, there's a famous book called Curious George Goes to the Hospital. And she helped the Rays, who were the authors of Curious George, write that book, you know, in conjunction with Children's Hospital. So, that was her job. She wasn't a community activist.
Understood. Right.
But she was very much in line with his thinking and what he was doing. And that would have been the height of the kind of anti-Vietnam protest movements. And that's when, you know, that's a lot of what we used to see in the house. And the interesting people always would come by. Everybody from Andrew Young to Jeb Magruder, who had studied with Bill... at Amherst. No, Williams, sorry.
That's fascinating. I could see all the connections there. Ben Spock was, of course, there, as you mentioned, as well. And he, of course, his primary job was birthing and, you know, having an impact on that.
He's the ultimate baby doctor.
Yep. Generations of women and their children.
Yes.
Right. Were influenced by that, by his books. So all this must have impressed you terribly. Like by the time you were ready to start storytelling, I mean, you must have had this rich background already because of that.
Yeah, I mean, he was you know, I wouldn't say I followed in his footsteps, but he was an inspirational figure, there's no doubt. And also a great storyteller, I must say. Not only in his preferred medium, which was the pulpit. I mean, he could give a speech like nobody you ever seen. He was just, you know, captivating. But also, he was, you know, hanging around. He was a great, great storyteller.
Yeah. So did you start off wanting to make documentaries?
Well, I don't know if I did. I mean, I in high school I was certainly interested in films and my dad was a journalist and that was interesting to me. So I I was raised. My mom was also a writer, so I was raised by two writers. And when I went to college, I would say that I became more and more interested in film. And it was a great time to go to college because this would have been, I think I graduated in 77, so a long time ago. But, every night there were four or five film societies operating, and you could go see a different movie every night. And, sometimes fiction, sometimes nonfiction. And so I just was, I came out of college believing in the power of cinema. And, was influenced as much by Fred Wiseman and the Maisels brothers as I was by, Scorsese and all these young Turks who were making movies that were somehow not, they didn't feel so manufactured. They felt both exciting and kind of personal all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. When you're making going into making a film about someone, whether it's Elliot Spitzer, Lance Armstrong, or Fela Kuti, how big a challenge or difference is it in your approach if that person's no longer living?
Well, it certainly limits the access.
But you have to think also, I assume, about how to honor or approach that. And I don't know if you think about these things very thoroughly in a different way, different manner.
I think it's the approach is always the same. Obviously, you can't, access them. Lance Armstrong, Elliot Spitzer, you can talk to them. Sometimes, as in the case of Julian Assange, he was living. He's still living. And I talked to him a lot, but he would never agree to talk on camera. So you do the best you can. But I always thought that, the interesting way in is always to be as curious as possible, to find out as much as possible, and then slowly make a determination. I mean, yeah, to be honest with you, when I started this project, the film that became Finding Fela, it was to have been a documentary that was very much present day. It was going to follow the Broadway troupe as they took the show Fela to Lagos. And I thought that would be interesting. These Americans who are doing an African show now going back to Africa. And we shot that. But I think that one of the things that happened along the way was I and others in on the filmmaking team got seduced by the real Fela at the same time. And
right.
So it became, I'm not an expert in Fela Kuti, and so it became a kind of exercise which was not unlike the exercise that the people in the Broadway show went on, which is why I call the film Finding Fela.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how do you find out who a person like this is and what makes him tick?
It's almost incidental then, or perhaps accidental, that because you were interviewing a number of not only people that knew him well and family, but those like Bill T. Jones, the famous modern dance choreographer,
yes,
who was choreographing, right, Finding Fela. They were trying to, investigate this person, and figure out, because he was so complex, what drove him and what made him tick, and to get inside of that. And through that, we have someone who's kind of doing some of this excavation for us as we're watching it.
That's
you
right. Because I think they traveled the same path that we ultimately traveled, and it's very interesting. They're trying to get at the heart of the man. Mm. What was it that drove him? And I think Bill T. Jones was very interested in, and luckily, when we started this process, we had access to these wonderful films, which were made during the invention, really, of the off-Broadway play. As they were all trying to figure it out,
mm-hmm.
and Bill, I think, was quite interested in what he called the madness. That is to say, there was something unhinged about Fella that was leading him up in places, like many artists, in ways that he couldn't necessarily quite articulate. At the same time, he had a very explicit political agenda, at least after a certain period of time. And so, what is that confluence of personal and political forces that makes such an interesting person? And they took a slice of life and set his life in the context of a nightclub performance, which seemed very apt for Fella, because in his performances in the Shrine in Lagos, it was always a mix of kind of revival meeting, musical performance, a lecture, kind of Q&A session back and forth with the audience, as Fella would do his thing called Yabis, which was kind of rapping about mm-hmm. political issues of the day. So it was
and these were these basically done impromptu?
His riffs were basically impromptu. I mean, his music was a very clever mix of a rigorous composition and improvisation. And I mean, he took a lot from jazz, and then he got a lot from funk. He's also an exemplar of cross-cultural influences. That he was taking from a lot. Everything from the church music he would hear, from sort of Yoruba tunes to jazz, and then he comes to the United States in 1969, and he starts listening to James Brown,
mm-hmm.
and also getting a lesson. He got a lesson from a guy named Bernie Hamilton, who was an actor and owned a club in L.A. He said, you got to remember Kiss. The fella's like, what's that? What's Kiss? Bernie says, keep it simple, stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his way of thinking, you can get as complicated as you want around the margins, but your groove should be simple.
So he was talking musically, keep it simple.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, he became a leader or symbolic leader, I guess, for African political
resistance.
Resistance, exactly, yeah. And, I don't know how much that he thought through. He remains somewhat opaque to me still. We know that he had his, attributes and his failings, and he was we're all flawed, but I was wondering how much he thought through, or if he had by design, wanted to have this role.
Many rock stars are narcissists. They feed off
sure.
the love and adulation that they get
yeah.
from the crowd.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising, in a performer that you see a little bit of that. But, combined with that, his desire to make a difference, and I think that was sincere. He fell in love with a woman in L.A. named Sandra Isidore,
mm-hmm.
Who very much encouraged him. She was very dismissive at first, because she came to hear one of his performances and heard him singing in Yoruba and asked him what he's singing about. He said, well, he's singing about my soup. He said, well, what kind of thing is that to sing about? What do you, I want you to sing about something important,
mm-hmm.
like how to change things. And that was right around the time of, James Brown's, I'm Black and I'm Proud.
Mm-hmm.
So he got that message. And he began to start to integrate some of, a desire to make a difference. But over time, I think, you can't help but
mm-hmm.
but become aware of your own importance, and you feed off that. But he was so he's narcissistic, but also, let's face it, he took the blows for a lot of other people. I mean, he was a lightning rod for a pretty brutal bolts of lightning thrown at him and the Nigerian people by the state.
And he spent a good he spent a number of years in prison.
Spent a number of years in prison. He was beaten rather badly any number of times. His mother was thrown off a second floor window. She was tremendously influential to him. Bill T. Jones in the play makes a good bit of use of her. I think that he was very drawn to her, and also he understood that. I think he suggests that he understood that in some way he was the one who put her at risk.
Mm-hmm.
He was inspired by her political engagement, but at the end of the day, the way he seceded, I mean, he had a commune, which he called Calakuta, which he announced was seceding from Nigeria. And I think some of those actions and the provocative songs that he wrote, I think he realized at some point that it may have caused her to be killed.
Well, you see, I didn't die because I have death in my pouch. I can't die. They can't kill me.
He was a synthesizer and he was also a visionary. And at the same time, he's dangerous.
This man just caused trouble for everybody.
By the time he comes out of prison in 86, he was like second only to Nelson Mandela.
What does it mean to be out there in the street caring enough that you're going to stick your neck out again to be punched, stabbed, arrested?
As far as Africa is concerned, music cannot be for enjoyment. Music has to be for revolution. Music is the way forward.
Yeah, he was an enormous threat too. Right?
He was. I think that as a cultural force, he was an enormous threat. It makes you realize the power of culture. I mean, Fella says music is the weapon,
mm-hmm.
And I think music is the weapon in a way that's a more profound than just lyrics, which are political. There's a kind of emotional expression and a refusal, to be trampled, and a kind of embracing of the human spirit. Music is the weapon because there's no shield for the power of the human heart. I mean, I think that's the idea. And so the music took hold in the Nigerian people, African people, and ultimately people around the world. And that became a kind of source of emotional resistance to corruption and what his manager called Ziggy Zaggery. I love that phrase.
Ziggy Zaggery.
Yeah.
this music, from what I heard... This Afrobeat has this very trance-like nature to it because of the pulsing rhythm. And so I can imagine as being in the audience, these enormous, concerts that they ultimately grew into, that, you would just sort of become mesmerized on some level. I don't mean to, belittle anybody who went to it, because I'm sure everybody could think for themselves. But I imagine it had to be an enormous, forceful experience to go to a concert of that size with that kind of music. And then there is the inserted messages in there. That'd be an extremely powerful experience.
I agree. I think because it's not like
it
I
wasn't
said,
a balladeer,
right? It's not just about the lyrics. It's about the groove.
Mm-hmm.
And his music had a very powerful groove.
Mm-hmm.
Two bands, the famous ones, Africa 70, which was really driven by a wonderful drummer named Tony Allen, and then a later band, which had a kind of mellower groove in a way, but also very, very powerful, called Egypt 80. And these songs get their power by repetition. Mm-hmm. It presented a bit of a conundrum, really, for us as filmmakers, in the sense that you can't dip in and out or it's hard to dip in and out of a Fela Kuti song, because it, they get their power from the repetition. I mean, it's very eclectic music. It's not purely African in any way, shape, or form. But it does also certainly have a very African root. But that groove, man, is intense, and that's what carries you. And you know, you can shake your butt to that music, and then as what Questlove says in the film, you know, it's a wild ride, these songs, which sometimes are 20 or even 30 minutes long. You know, you're on this groove for 10, 15 minutes, and then the song starts. You know, that's when the lyrics begin. Because up to that point, you know, you've got the drums, you got the rhythm, you got the bass, and now the horns come in.
It builds. It keeps building.
It keeps
in
building.
Intensity in it, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And there seems to, there was also a history between, I think, you know, the well, a lot of jazz, of course, came out of it and was birthed in the States, but there seems to be kind of a dialogue going back with Africa over the years.
Absolutely. You know. No doubt.
And almost any music form to actually, I think, rock and roll to hip-hop, there seems to constantly be back, you know, right?
So I think great culture, I mean, I think great music is always a mix of, you know, always gets made when cultures collide.
Right.
That's when the interesting stuff happens.
Maybe all art, in a sense, because film, it's happened in film, too, with whether it was samurai films and going, you know, and then gangster films and, you know, coming between Japan and America and then the new wave films,
right.
Filmmakers and American filmmakers, there's this that occurs, and certainly in some of the other fine arts, so it would make sense. Does this fall into your sort of subcategory of music docs, do you think, or is this kind of diverged in a way?
I don't know. I'm not trying to
categorize
my own films. Obviously, I was intrigued by this subject because he was, you know, the music he made was great, and I went and saw the show, and I was, you know, I loved it. But also, there was a political element here. So the idea of, you know, where is that sweet spot in the intersection of politics and art? Because, you know, art that becomes too political becomes, in my view, kind of shrill and you know, pamphleteering. And doesn't have any humanity or any curiosity in it, or doesn't embrace any contradictions. It becomes, you know, it almost becomes that which you're allegedly fighting against, you know, a simple stick to beat people over the head with. But here was a guy who was making great music and really fighting hard. But he was also a fascinating character, and I'm interested in these larger, some of these larger-than-life characters who both use and abuse power in ways that are interesting.
To come full circle in a way, as you were talking about delivering politics and connecting on a political level with people, folks like, you know, your stepfather were able to figure that out real well. Like, you know, how to reach people. In the end, you still have to talk on a human level, on an emotional gut level. It doesn't help to be you know, didactic about it. You will remember.
I mean, you can be passionate about a certain idea or a message, but I think, you know, one of the things that was great about that I always admired about my stepfather was he was one of those people who would engage almost anybody in dialogue. And that, I think, is something that, you know, is sadly more and more missing, you know, as we fragment into our internet cones. You know, it was a relief to lose the world of the three networks, you know, where everything was, you know, pre-digested and so homogenized. But now, you know, we've all retreated into our cones, and it's just a kind of feedback loop. You know, my stepfather was great at engaging people who would otherwise be, you know, you'd think would be completely, why would he bother? Why wouldn't he just hang with his own peeps who believed, you know, who preached, you know,
just talk to the
members
choir.
Of the choir.
Yeah,
yeah, he was preaching to the choir. Yeah. He did far more than preach to the choir.
Sure. Yeah. What would he have made of your career as it's
well, you know,
grown
we talked about it.
Years.
He was both he and my dad died the same year. In fact, within a few days of each other. And
wow.
And indeed, there was one issue of the Washington Post where my dad was on the top page and my stepfather was on the bottom page. They occupied one whole page.
That had to be kind of a surreal experience.
It was surreal. I mean, even more surreal for my mother, imagine.
I can't.
I think that, you know, he was... you know, Bill had seen Enron and knew I was working on Taxi to the Dark Side about torture, about which he felt very strongly. So, you know, he was pleased.
As you speak, I was thinking, you know, this is such a compelling story. Not that this has to be the one that you would tell, but I do wonder, as I think back through, you know, the documentaries that you've made, and there's so much, they're practically in real time with the, you know, a lot of them. This is not a case with Finding Fella, as it happens, but with Lance Armstrong, Lily Spitzer, as you said, Julian Assange, a number of others.
Enron,
right. The smartest guys in the room.
Right.
And Taxi to the Dark Side on some level. These are stories that are very immediate. And, but I'm wondering, would you be, or maybe you have, make a more personal documentary, tell us a much more personal story that comes from your own life?
Well, you know, I had been trying.
Have you?
I've been trying for some years to do a film of actually about Bill, one that would be about him, but also my relationship with him, which I thought would be interesting. You know, so far I haven't been able to get anybody interested in funding that film. Maybe when I get through the next few years, I'll just do it myself.
Yeah, you know, you could try this new thing they have called crowdsourced funding.
Crowdsourcing, yeah.
You know,
it's,
it like, also,
it's awkward. I feel embarrassed to go do crowdsourcing for a film about myself. I think I could self-fund that one.
I see. I
right.
Gotcha.
It's
yeah.
just, you know, but to do films like this, you have to buy a lot of archive and stuff like that. But, you know, I've been collecting material over time. I think I'll get there.
I think that would make a great story. Great documentary. Again, Finding Fella, the new Alex Gibney documentary, is premiering theatrically in New York and in, I assume,
in cities around the country.
Cities around the country. And then probably in other countries thereafter. But it starts here on August 1st.
Correct.
Friday, August 1st. And it's being distributed by Kino Lorber, which I think is a great partnership, actually. So thank you so much for finding time. I hope that you'll come back and.
Thank you. Delighted.
Talk about
you good
know, future project. Thanks a lot. Maybe now that he's sat through the Filmwax interview, he'll consider coming back for a longer conversation. I hope so. But, you know, one that kind of deals with more than just the last film or something. You know, something that's a little bit broader. All right. So, Dan Kraus, this is a movie. I got contacted by Oscilloscope, which is the distributor of The Kill Team. This is about a very notorious incident, series of incidents that occurred. Where a group of soldiers that were in Afghanistan committed some atrocities by killing innocent Afghans. And the film kind of focuses on infantryman Adam Winfield, who is a very young guy who got caught up in it. He was caught between a rock and a hard place in the sense that the amount of pressure not to turn on your own unit and soldiers in your unit is tremendous to the point where it can actually be dangerous because once you're outside, you know, you could definitely be put in harm's way by your own fellow soldiers. So here's a little bit about the film. The Kill Team goes behind closed doors to tell the riveting story of Specialist Adam Winfield, a 21-year-old infantryman in Afghanistan who attempted, with the help of his father, to alert the military to some heinous crimes that his platoon was committing. but those pleas were unheeded, and so so here Dan Krause, the filmmaker, has unbelievable access and interviews most of the soldiers that were involved and have been arrested and imprisoned, frankly. So it's quite an incredible, explosive story. And this is my conversation with Dan. I do want to mention one thing, and that is that the Kill Team is, I believe, currently playing at the Film Society of Lincoln Center at the Eleanor Bunin Monroe Theater. I may be wrong, but I believe it's still there. Double check. Starting August 1st, it's also in Berkeley, California, at the Landmark Shattuck Theater, and then also in San Francisco at the Landmark Opera Plaza. So you can check that out. And then next week, it opens in Los Angeles at the Landmark New Art Theater, and on the 15th in Seattle, and on. You can go to killteammovie.com, click on See the Film, and you can find out all the details about where the Kill Team is playing. It's a big deal. It premiered last year at the Tribeca Film Festival to great acclaim, and I'm very excited to bring to you my conversation with filmmaker Dan Krause.
I was 19, fresh out of high school. Thought I knew everything that there was to know, but man, I was really, really wrong.
Five U.S. soldiers stand accused of shocking crimes that include murdering Afghans for sport.
This was the platoon from hell.
We were smoking, we were high, and Morlock's like, man, you know, we straight murdered that dude.
You guys set this guy up to get shot. Whatever.
Right on, man. We got to kill, whether, you know, it was... We know he's a bad guy or not.
Why am I the only one that's not okay with this?
After the first murder,
everything that I believed in the Army was gone.
People in my platoon, they just changed. Something in them changed.
Specialist Adam Winfield's father, Chris, warned the Army, but tragically, Army officials refused to investigate. His son, now charged in the third killing.
I never wanted to kill anyone, ever.
Hi. Nice to meet you, Dan.
Nice to meet you.
Your film is called The Kill Team.
It is, yes.
And... if you hear anything, this is the soundtrack of New York City in the background on Canal Street in New York.
It comes with the territory.
It does, it does. Your film is called The Kill Team, and very quickly, it's a well-known or documented case of this platoon of American soldiers who were in southern Afghanistan, correct?
Correct.
In 2011 or 12?
They were deployed in the fall of 2009, and these crimes occurred in early 2010.
Oh, okay. Many of them probably succumbed to it due to peer pressure, for lack of another term, perhaps, and boredom. I mean, I understand all the reasons that they ended up committing murders, basically, of Afghan civilians in some cases, right? And it's also this sort of phenomenon, like the Milgram experiments, where one gives in to pressure of what's expected of you. And
yeah, I mean, I think one thing I learned in making this film is how great a priority the group is to these soldiers. It supersedes any other moral impulse that they have, because the group is the thing that is going to keep you in one piece, get you home safely. And so to step outside that group, to become an individual and divorce yourself from that group, is a very, very difficult thing to do. And so the tendency and the impulse is to stay with that group, even right. if it starts going in a direction that may be seemingly objectionable. The idea of abandoning the group is even more repulsive and right. more potentially dangerous.
An unsustainable thing. Like this notion that we've been learning through generations of the brothers in arms, band of brothers, the Army really knows how to use that in terms of all the marketing.
It's a very real thing, actually. I mean, I think, you know, I had a vague familiarity with this idea of the band of brothers, the unity among and the brotherhood among the soldiers, but I didn't recognize fully how strong that impulse is, how important it is to all of them, and especially in an environment like southern Afghanistan, which is incredibly treacherous and also very alien, and you're a young kid who depends on the guys around you and your superiors to keep you safe, that bond becomes the only thing that that you can really depend on for your right. your survival. It's incredibly critical to all of them to maintain that to maintain that cohesion.
Right, but there's a deep betrayal in there too, because the military in general, as well as the sergeant, was it the
Gibbs? Yeah, Staff Sergeant Gibbs. Yeah,
and the leadership really ends up using them in a sense, and just to sort of tossing them off in a way. Once they're tried, and nobody takes responsibility for this type of dynamic that's created there. And
I mean, that's
the more the complexities of this.
Right. I mean, part of the much of the criticism on behalf of the families of the soldiers who were charged and the soldiers themselves is this notion that there should have been culpability assigned to officers further up the chain of command, that the military has a tendency to buffer the upper echelons of command from the turbulence of these kind of episodes so that it resides only with the lower ranking soldiers. And, you know, I think that's probably, you know, I think there's some truth to that. I also want to make known that the Army carried out an internal investigation of its command
yes.
climates. And right. so they have made some steps towards trying to understand what it was about the structure of this command and the maybe perhaps the dysfunction of mm-hmm. this command that led to these episodes. There is some sort of effort. They're not completely blind to this phenomenon.
Yeah, I remember there was a documentary a couple of years ago on rapes.
Yeah,
The Invisible War, which involved not only sexual abuse. From senior officers to not just women, but also to men too. Of course, that was a big deal, and I think it really was an opportunity that the military had to look at themselves in a different way and
yeah.
take some more culpability for the things that were happening. I don't know if that it played any kind of role in these cases where the Army is under more scrutiny and they have to kind of step in sooner to.
Yeah, I mean,
take responsibility.
Right. I think it's an open question. In a certain light, you can say that the Army did its job, right? They got their man. You know, Staff Sergeant Gibbs was sentenced to life in prison. Adam got 3 years. You could say that justice was served, but I think a lot of people would argue that larger questions about the command and the culture and the institutional responsibility were ignored.
Right. So tell me, though, was getting access to all the soldiers, because it appears that you're interviewing most of the soldiers that were in this company, right?
I interviewed four of the five soldiers that three of the five soldiers that have been charged with murder, and then the one soldier who was credited in the press as being the whistleblower,
okay.
Justin Stoner.
And you referred to Adam before. That's Adam Winfield, who attempted during the course of these crimes while he was away to reach out to his family, and he was like emailing them about what was going on and his level of discomfort as things got worse and worse. And, because his father was also from the military, I believe, right?
Well, he was in the Marines.
Yeah. So they believed that his son, you know, was just going to be able to stick it out for a little longer, and then they would do what they could.
It was even more complicated than that because they made a conscious decision at a certain point. First, their impulse was to attempt to contact as many branches of the military and the government as possible.
And alert them to these crimes.
Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, when they weren't getting the responses that they expected or hoped, they started to fear that if they continued making calls, that they would put their son's life in danger because
right.
of word filtered back to his unit that he had voiced a complaint.
They
would have known, and they could have handled things the way that they saw fit, which, you know, as we saw with Justin Stoner, he was assaulted by the platoon for ratting them out about hash use. So imagine the sorts of retribution that would occur if they understood that Adam was ratting them out about murder. So
yeah.
they made a conscious decision at a certain point to remain quiet and to ask Adam to stay away from these other soldiers and report the crimes when he was safely home.
As you mentioned a few minutes ago about the Army seems to be being more proactive about scrutiny. Did this help you, in fact? do your story? I guess that's what I was getting to, because you did interview, as you said, four of the five guys.
Well, I didn't work through the military to make the film. It was immediately clear to me when I initiated production that that the military wouldn't allow me to tell the story in the way that I wanted from the inside. And at that point, the sensitivity around the, you know, these trials and these court martials and the crimes themselves was very, very high. And there was a real lockdown kind of, situation with respect to all of these cases. So access was not going to come through the military. And that's why I found this other unique arrangement through the Defense Council to be present for all this.
What is that?
Well, I had a conversation with Adam's attorney early on, and there was an opportunity for me to do some filming that would be useful for both of us, both the defense and myself. They needed some limited amount of material, interview material with the Winfield family to show who they were as people. Mm-hmm. And I needed the same for a film. And so we had sort of parallel ambitions at that point, and we came to an understanding that that I could film a bit of the pretrial process so long as they had a limited access to some of this interview material. And that's how I got my foot in the door and first had an opportunity to speak with the Winfields and approach them with this idea of a film, and also to find out for myself whether a film was there, whether they could be partners with me in this. And that was the first step, is making that agreement with the defense team that allowed me to be present for all this pretrial process, but also retain ownership and control of whatever material I generated.
Mm-hmm. These young men knew that they were... It was almost guaranteed that most of them were going to spend time in prison, and so they still agreed, and they seemed to be very open about it. What had happened and what their feelings about it.
Yeah, well, and, I mean,
it's pretty impressive.
In the case of Morlock, he had already been sentenced. Jeremy Morlock had already been sentenced to 24 years in prison.
This is the one from Wasilla.
What's that?
This is the
Wasilla, Alaska. Yes,
yes.
He had already been charged and sentenced to 24 years and was serving his time. So he was serving as a witness in the court martials of the other soldiers. So he had comparatively little to lose. I mean, he wasn't going to put his judicial process in any jeopardy by speaking with me. And also, you know, I made clear to everybody, and I agreed in writing, of course, but also on a practical level, there was no way this film was going to be produced and released before the trials and the judicial process was completed. So there was no danger of my work influencing
positively or negatively,
positive or negatively, sure, the outcome of these cases. And that was critical to everyone, of course. And so that was one reason that I think these soldiers also had a level of comfort with me that perhaps they wouldn't with a journalist who would turn around a story in a day or two or a week when these events were still fresh or still occurring. I was in a very different position where a film would be released a year or so down the line and not have the same sort of impact that it would have if it was in, you know, a newspaper or magazine while it was still happening.
I noted you're an Oscar-nominated filmmaker. Your last film, which is called The Death of Kevin Carter, was nominated for an Oscar. Was that a short or is that a feature?
It was a short.
It was a short. Okay, so I haven't seen that one. Why haven't I seen that one?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, that film sort of paved the way for this film a little bit.
Who's Kevin Carter then?
Well, Kevin Carter was a war photographer in South Africa who was confronted with a moral crisis of his own, another situation with a suite of choices that had no possibility of a good outcome. And so when I read about Adam Winfield, I thought, well, here we are again. You know, this is the same thing. You know, another young guy amidst the context of conflict who is confronted with a lot of really bad options. And how do you make that choice when no option is good?
Oh, it's interesting to talk about heroic behavior and impulses, because the same soldiers, any of them, might have been just as willing to throw themselves on a grenade or in harm's way for one of their brothers or for maybe even somebody else. We have an easier time reducing these people and instances to one or the other, you know, on the end of the spectrum. Yeah. So a hero is a hero, and this is a criminal, you know, and nothing in between.
Right. Right. I think that's, and I think a lot of soldiers are disturbed at that tendency. And I think, you know, it's interesting. Some soldiers don't want to be celebrated as heroes. And many soldiers, I mean, there's certainly heroism that occurs in war, no doubt about it. I mean, I have a tremendous amount of respect for soldiers who carry themselves heroically or with distinction in combat. I mean, of course, that's incredibly laudable and something that is that we should all, you know, respect. But I think what we don't talk about as much are the human beings that are serving overseas that are capable of both good and bad. And are sometimes forced to do things that go against their ingrained sense of morality. And that is more and more a hallmark of this war. It's been a hallmark of war since the beginning of recorded history, but it's being recognized more and more now that the longest war in U.S. history is drawing to a close. There's, in fact, a term used to describe this very phenomenon, which is termed a moral injury. And it's this idea that you carry this tremendous guilt from having done something or not prevented something from happening that you find morally repugnant. And how do you live with that decision when you've made a decision in the heat of battle in a split second often that carries the most profound consequences?
In the middle of nowhere, he had the Taliban shooting him at him on one side. He had his own guys threatening to kill him on his other side.
Of all the people out there, he was the only one that did anything.
He had guns pointed at him in both directions. What do you do?
I wish that I could fix it.
There was no way for me not to be a part of it. It was impossible not to surrender to the insanity of it all.
It's all about getting that first kill and going home with a mark that says you killed somebody.
We're training you from the day you join to the day you're out to kill everything that gets in your way. Well, then why the hell are you pissed off when we do it?
Sometimes you're forced to do something or you feel as though you failed to do something that was wrong. And that's a wound that's very different than post-traumatic stress. There's a lot of discussion of the horrors of war and what soldiers were forced to witness. And that's a very urgent and worthwhile discussion. But I think in concert with that, there also needs to be a discussion about the tremendous guilt of the soldiers who felt that they perpetrated or carried out some sort of wrongdoing because they felt in that moment that they needed to, not because they had some evil impulse or had some intention of doing wrong, but that they in that moment felt that they had to make a decision and it ended up being the wrong decision. That's a very difficult kind of wound to live with, and there's no kind of medical therapy that you can assign to that kind of wound that's going to cleanse you. It's something that you have to live with for the rest of your life.
The Kill Team, which is the film we've been talking about, directed by Dan Kraus, you premiered it at Tribeca in 2013?
Correct.
By the time you're actually listening to this, it will already be in New York. But if you're living on the West Coast, the good news is it's expanding to L.A. and then San Francisco in the coming...
I think it's actually the reverse. It's San Francisco then L.A. But yes, we're coming back west in the following couple of weeks.
Okay. And because it's being distributed by Oscilloscope, there'll be other ways to see this wonderful film. Dark at times, but still it's a terrific film. And you've made conversations in a room very interesting. And there's no archive footage here. These are, this is something, if we had a little bit more time, I would ask you about.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you just briefly if you
yes,
want.
Yes, please
you
do.
Know, that all of that material was evidence that was confiscated, the military confiscated from the soldiers themselves, from their laptops and cameras. So all of that, all of the material that you see from Afghanistan is actually the real McCoy. I mean, it's it's imagery and video that was captured by the soldiers who were involved.
It's true. It's an amazing story. And I noted also that one of your executive producers is my old friend Julia Goldman,
yes,
who I went to summer camp with as kids. I've known her since we know each other since we're like 8 years old.
No kidding.
I know. Yeah. Well, I wish you much success with the film. And
thank you.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. I assume still in touch with these guys. Have any of them been able to see the film?
The guys that are in prison have not been able to see it.
But
Justin Stoner has seen it. Of course, the Winfield family has seen it. The Winfield family is very supportive.
What do they make of it? Yeah.
Well, you know, when I first approached them, I made very clear that I was not going to make the Free Adam Winfield movie, that this was not a film about the sort of more familiar story of the wrongly imprisoned man. This was something that was more complicated. And I think they respected that. And in the end, when they saw the film, they appreciated that the story told a very human perspective on what happened. It was truthful. And it encompassed all of the complexities that they had endured and are still enduring. And so I think, you know, just as you mentioned earlier, you know, that soldiers are not always heroes or always bad guys. Sometimes they're a little of both. I think Adam feels that way. And I think he was pleased that the film didn't try to portray him as either a hero or a victim, but something more human.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Well, he sounds very reasonable, and you know, I hope the best for him. And when he comes out of prison and he's able to...
Oh, he's out.
Oh, he is? Yes, Adam's out already?
He's out, yeah.
Did he do time served to some degree?
He had... his sentence was 3 years,
right.
And then he got credit for time served and work credit. So he ended up serving 2 years and change, all told.
Right.
And he was released and is living with his family now in Florida, attending college classes, studying engineering, trying his best to put this episode behind him. But of course, everything in his life constantly reminds him and pulls him back towards this. You know, he has this shadow following him now that... will probably, you know, be with him for the rest of his life. So it's a difficult thing to live with, as I mentioned earlier, and particularly when you have an involuntary manslaughter charge on your record, and every time you apply for a job or some sort of educational opportunity,
I can't imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really hard thing. Yeah. Not only because it's a complicated story, but because it makes him go back to that place mentally where he just can't go, and so. So it's a very, you know, he's trying to escape this part of his life and not let it define him, but unfortunately it's following him.
Well, again, the movie's, it's opening Friday, the 25th?
The 25th tonight, yes.
It is.
It is. And we have Mark Boll coming to do the question and answers with me and conversation with me tonight, which is a tremendous feather in our cap to have him present to speak about the film. He first reported the story in Rolling Stone, and of course has produced and written Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker. So he has a kind of an authoritative voice in this subject matter.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations on that. And I again, when people are listening to this, it'll be after that fact, but it's good to mention it.
Yes.
Because it's there for the history.
Well, for those that hear it,
exactly.
They'll be sorry they weren't there.
Precisely. But you can see the Kill Team. There's different ways, and we'll post all those options. And hopefully you come back next time again when you have your next project.
Yeah,
and
I would love to.
I appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah, likewise.
The next episode of FilmWax Radio next week is with filmmaker Tom Gilroy. His film, The Cold Lands, is coming out on Fandor. The episode is sponsored by Fandor, not surprisingly. And Tom is the director. I had on Lily Taylor, the star of the movie, some time ago, and didn't get a chance to bring Tom on until now. But the timing worked out really well, and we'll be playing that episode for you in just a few days. And then... also in August, my conversation with filmmaker Dan Schechter, who a couple years back made supporting characters with Alex Karpovsky and Sofia Dacal. I don't know if you remember that, but now he has a new film about to come out with Jennifer Aniston, and she is fantastic in it. And it also has John Hawkes and Tim Robbins is in it, and Mos Def, and a bunch of other amazing actors. It's so good. It's adapted from an Elmore Leonard screenplay that Dan wrote. And Dan has been on before, and this time we sat down for a nice long chat, and I'm going to put that up right before Life of Crime comes out. And then I'm going to also put up soon my conversation with editor Sam Pollard, as well as another great long conversation that I had with Robert Downey Sr., the underground experimental filmmaker from the 70s, 60s and 70s, truthfully. And he was a lovely, lovely man. He's Iron Man's dad, for God's sake. But he was as available and down-to-earth as you could possibly imagine. And I'm setting up much, much more. So please keep tuning in, and please subscribe if you don't subscribe already. It makes all the difference in the world. And lastly, you can reach me at adam@filmwax.com if you want to email me, or you can reach me on Facebook at, I'm on Facebook, or you can reach the Filmwax Radio page at facebook.com/filmwaxradio and at Twitter at Filmwax Radio, not so surprisingly. So easy to be in touch. Let me know you're out there. Another, possibly the most effective way, is just putting a comment on our iTunes page. Just go to iTunes Store and search Filmwax or Filmwax Radio, and then leave a comment and a star rating. I always make that plea, and, you know, it's hard to get people to do it, but if you're listening, just take a moment and do it, and let me know you're there. And also, as a result, more people will find the show. And so I thank you very kindly for all of your support. Okay? So until next time, this is Adam Chartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films.